So, I talked a little bit about shared memory programming, parallel programming, channels, OCaM last week. About ADA, rendezvous, and we'll go continue on in that trend. So we had shared variables, shared memory, that was easy to use, but there were race conditions, there were deadlocks, live locks in programming, shared memory, parallel programming. So it's conceptually easy, but its implementation is tricky. Right, so we'll talk about the ways of getting around some of these problems. There was remote procedure calls when you have different machines. The problem with distributed machines with remote procedure call is it's different from shared memory programming, so it's a little trickier conceptually to handle. Then there are, of course, mixtures. Mixtures where you're mixing shared memory programming with distributed memory programming to get a sort of hybrid programming model where you as a programmer have more opportunities for optimization. That's the whole idea for hybrid shared memory, distributed memory programming. If you go completely shared memory, even for a distributed memory machine, where you're hiding effectively distributed nature of your cluster behind some shared memory abstraction, then the system, the underlying system, is responsible for all the performance. And most of the time, such a runtime system or a compiler cannot fully optimize your program. If you go to a fully distributed memory machine with a distributed memory programming model, then all of the optimization is in your hands, and the compiler and the runtime systems don't have to do anything at all. Again, not optimal, right? You want the compiler and the programming language to handle some of the burden of either optimization or debuggability or correctness for you. So it makes sense to have some sort of mixture between shared memory and distributed memory programming. Right. We'll look into some of these models in a bit. So the first idea is, if you have shared memory or if you have distributed memory, there are it's all fairly low level. You want to lift the amount of abstraction a bit, and this is where Lindac comes in, and tuple spaces. The idea here is to program your program like if it were a database. So instead of having shared variables, you have records in a database that you manipulate. For consistency, you are only allowed, the system guarantees you that when you retrieve a tuple from the database, it will be atomically extracted from the database. The system itself can handle either shared memory or distributed memory. If you have a distributed memory machine, so you have multiple individual machines, conceptually, the database is partitioned over all the machines. So if in one machine you do a get from database, you retrieve a tuple from a database, a record from a database, then it will be removed from whatever machine holds the that record, and you get a copy. Then you manipulate that record and you place it back into the database. So the database is an abstraction over memory, right? So there are bindings for this tuple space on top of various programming languages, for example, C, C++, Pascal, Java, Prolog, and so forth. So the number of things that we add to the language for Lindac support are only three or four things. Out tuple, to add something to the database, in, to retrieve something from the database, and read, to see if something is in the database. There's also an eval thing, but we don't care about eval for now. So all of the machines and all of the cores and all the machines everywhere, every multi-core machines, every core on a multi-core machine can do some database manipulation. Right? There are no race conditions, because the system guarantees that putting something in the database or retrieving something from the database is atomic. Right? So it's a transactional idea. If you have databases, you have transactions, and getting something from a database or putting something into a database is via a sort of transaction. So there are no race conditions. There is a potential for deadlock. Well, it's not really a deadlock. It's more of a logical deadlock. If you try and remove something from the database, but it is not yet in the database, then your core or your machine will block until somebody else puts it into the database. Right? So if you try to retrieve something from the database, but nobody ever puts it into the database, you have a sort of a deadlock. But it can also, it's sort of a strange deadlock. It's more like a programming error. But there, at least there can be no race conditions, right? Because this database abstraction hides atomicity. This is an example, right? You have integer x, and then you do an in to see if something, to block until somebody puts that item into the database, right? And it's like a query, right? It finds a record where the first item is ABC, then the second is 0.1, and then you want X as the return value. So it's get a tuple that matches this structure of that record. The same for putting something into the database. And these two statements can then be run in parallel on different machines or on different cores. The efficiency of such a thing, it can be fairly high. The trick of getting some performance out of a sort of Lindau systems is the compiler. The compiler should try to transform such Lindau programs into more efficient message passing programs. So the compiler should analyze these ins and outs and replace them with send and receives to get some real performance. With these performance improvements in place, a Lindau program is translated to a message passing program, and that can run very efficiently. Right? So it looks like a database. It is not a database internally. Right? That's the message. These records may seem simple, but you can build more complex data structures on top of these records. You have a database which can store arbitrary records, and you can use these arbitrary records to logically create data structures, logically link data structures. For example, a shared variable is simple, right? You have a record with its first item is an X, a string, and you search in the database for a record with that string. So you can emulate shared memory programming on top of a tuple-based record database-style program. You can even simulate arrays, right? By having the array name and an index on as a record, and then the value as a third element of the tuple. Or even simulate trees, right? A tree with a first element a root and a left and a right. And then using an empty string to program a null pointer. So I can create complex data structures on top of databases. Right? So lists, trees, maps can all be emulated using records. And this gives you first the transactional semantics. Right? So there's no race conditions. And it pulls it towards a more higher level of abstraction for parallel programming. Orca. Orca is a fairly old language. The idea of Orca was to program clusters. So I have a cluster of single machines, a number of workstations connected via some network, and you want to program them at a higher level. You don't want to do you want to do sort of remote procedure call, but you also want to allow replication. What is the meaning of replication in combination with remote procedure call? Let's say I have a number of replicas of objects, and I want to invoke a method call on an object. Then that method call should be replicated as well on all the replicas. Right? What then happens when I have a number of replicas of objects, and one of them wants to change the object? Right? That's tricky. Should I then change all the replicas? And they aren't really replicas anymore. A replica is something that is equal in all machines. That's a little tricky. But for example, with Orca, they did was, if you want to change an object that is replicated over multiple machines, then one of these replicas is elected, its replica is changed, and after the operation, the replica is made consistent with all the other replicas by copying them, overriding them. There's no true object orientation. It was true object orientation was not the goal. Right? The idea was for research into cluster-based programming. Right, net ADTs, where you operate atomically on them. So if you do, say you have an integer object x, and then with x dollar assign, you perform a method event. So instead of dot with Java, you have the dollar sign. So x dot assign 3 is invokes a method assign on the x object, wherever x may be, and whether x may be replicated or not. These methods are called operations, and all of these operations work atomically. Right? So it's a lock, do code, and lock internally, conceptually. Right, so create complex objects. Have an object implementation int object with some integer field, and then a number of operations that work atomically. What's different in Orca is that there are guards. A guard is a statement that waits until any of these conditions become true. So you can write a number of guards, one after the other, in a block. And the first guard that triggers allows entry into the code. So for example, if you have a buffer, the entry to a put method was the condition, then the buffer was not full. Otherwise, you cannot do a put. Right? You cannot add something to a buffer if the buffer is full. So that condition is a guard towards the buffer add, to add something to the buffer add method. Right? So guards are tests to see when a entry into a critical section is allowed. We can write multiple guards, and the first one applicable allows entry. There's also a fork statement. A fork forks actual processes. It does not fork a thread, such as you see in normal programming languages that are contemporary. It really creates new processes. So whenever you say fork X, it creates a new process X that runs on some other machine. Right? A little more Orca. We have a ping-ponging between two processes. So first, the code starts here, create some counters, assign the count to 0, assign the end, so I wait until this number of ping-pongs have occurred. Then I fork a slave process to start executing on some other machine. I have an explicit allocation here, so that load balancing is your concern. It's not the concern of something internal. You as a programmer have to take care of load balancing. You say which process is running where. Right? Then you fork a slave for the end, so you have number of CPUs, number of processes at work, and then you block on an end weight, on a weight value for some zero, for the counter to reach 0. This is an atomic operation with a guard that waits until that counter reaches 0. Right? And the slave just decrements this wait counter until it reaches 0. So, shared variable programming was conceptually easy, but there are a number of details that make it really hard. Live locks, deadlocks are often named, but they are fairly benevolent. A deadlock and a live lock is easy to see when it occurs. And when it occurs, it's mostly deterministic. You run a program twice, and if a deadlock is there, it'll happen. Run it 4 times, you are guaranteed to see it. If you have a race condition, you can run it 100 times in practice, and you won't see it. Only the millionth times do you see the race actually occur. So the probability that a race occurs is fairly low, where the probability of a deadlock or a live lock occurring is fairly high. So the probability of a deadlock live lock is high, easy to see, easy to fix, and a race is hard to find when it occurs, and it's also very difficult to see when it occurs. So if a race condition occurs, some variable in memory is off by 1 over its correct value. Off by 1 is hard to detect. Right? Some variable in memory incremented too many times or too few times. It's hard to determine. So instead of giving shared variables a go, you can perhaps say, yes, let's just throw away shared variables and just see if we can live without shared variables. That's functional programming. The nice thing about functional programming is that every function is in principle in parallel. You do not have to think, can I run this function in parallel to that function? No. With functional programming, every function can be run in parallel. Because the shared functional programming says no side effects. If a function has no side effects, it cannot influence the execution of another method. Right? So every function can be run in parallel in functional programming. For example, in Miranda, so A is a function, B is a function, A is a function taking one argument, B is a function taking two arguments. These two A and B functions can always be run in parallel. You don't have to think if it's potentially incorrect or not. It's always correct. That's very nice. Alas, functional programming is hard because it forbids so many things that it'll force you to restructure your program in different ways to get some actual performance. The idea of parallel programming is to get performance. If I have to put in a lot of work in functional programming to get some of that performance back again, yeah, that doesn't really make sense, right? I want performance. Therefore, much of the functional programming is nonsense for performance programming. So, functional programming, good idea, doesn't really work as well in practice, so we have to go towards some form of imperative programming. The problem with imperative programming is overspecification. With imperative programming, the idea was specify what each statement does in turn. It exactly specifies how a for statement works, what the effects of a for statement is, how each declare or assignment works, what can be. It specifically forbids reordering. It specifically forbids that one assignment can be reordered with another assignment. So with an imperative programming, if I say AI is 3, and then later I say AI plus 1 is 4, then I am not allowed to swap these statements. Right? The compiler has to prove that these statements are okay to swap. Right? The compiler has to prove that it's okay to swap these statements. Right? The language by itself says that there should be no effects of reordering. Right? So overspecification in imperative programming. It says what the effects of statements should be in the order that they are applied. So there are too many things specified in the language manual. So imperative programming is not too nice. The compiler has to prove that something is okay to parallelize. Logic programming is fairly nice as well from a parallelism perspective. If you write a prolog program, you say something like X is true if Y or Z. X can also be made true by A or B. And now I have a query, X. Right? To prove X, I can run both of these sub-goals in parallel, and I can run all of these clauses in parallel as well. So there is or parallelism, and in this level there is AND parallelism. Right? So there's OR parallelism and parallelism in logic programming. So there's abundance of parallelism in logic programming. Unfortunately, in logic programming, we again manipulate most data by lists. And whenever you pass a list argument to another function, you again create a copy of a list, creating copies of copies of copies of lists, and performance is gone. So logic programming gives us abundant parallelism, but however, all the gains that we've got by all that parallelism is lost because inefficient implementation. So all three of them aren't really, really nice for parallel programming in some way or another. So what do we do? We create new languages. new languages for creating parallel programs, new ideas. One idea is agents or actors. So object-oriented programming, every object is passive, right? A thread needs to come by and invoke a method on an object, right? So an object is just a passive thing. It waits for somebody to come by and want something of it. Idea of an actor or an agent is that every object is active. An agent is an active object with its own thread, its own processor. Every object has a message, a mailbox. And whenever one of these agents has time, it looks into its mailbox. Is there a letter for me, a message? And when yes, it reads the message, reads the mail, and invokes a message, a method of itself in the response. So actors are active objects with mailboxes for communication. Again, there are no race conditions. All of these race conditions are hidden. Right? You send messages to other objects, place them in their mailbox, and that other guy, that agent, pulls things from its mailbox and executes them in response. So putting stuff in mailboxes and getting stuff from mailboxes, that is made atomic by the language definition itself, so there are no race conditions. So this is very nice. Deadlocks, virtually unheard of in these actor-style languages. Deadlocks can only happen if you have to actively wait. These systems do not actively wait. Right? You put something in a mailbox, but you do not wait for him to process that message. It's asynchronous message passing. Right? You put something in his mailbox and you continue execution yourself. You do not wait for the actor to pick up his mail. Right? Salsa is a fairly recent language for agent programming or actor programming. So you have active objects called behaviors, and you send message with one of these reverse arrow signs. Right? There's no mutual exclusion needed because putting something in a mailbox is atomic. And you have continuations, join blocks, tokens. We'll see what those are. Right? This is a simple Salsa program. You have a behavior, an active object, with a cell, with a get and a setter method. Right? The internal state is private, so every field is private, or every property is private by default. Right? You start with a foo. So the standard output is an agent as well. Right? Something in the background that waits for messages to be sent to him. So here I have some code that sends the print line message to the mailbox of the standard output agent, and the standard output agent can then pick up the message from its mailbox and execute the print line internally. Right? So everything is an agent. This is not actually correct. This can print foo, or hello, or world, or hello, because the order in which messages are processed in the mailbox is undefined. So it puts stuff in its mailbox, and the agent on the receiver side will just pull things from its mailbox in random orders. Right? So it's no guarantees. So if you want ordering to happen, you have to write these at signs. This is a continuation that says, once you finish executing this statement, then execute this statement. Right? So at is for explicit synchronization. Right. But how about return values? Right? I put in a request for a method invocation in somebody else's mailbox, and he'll execute that sometime later, right? Asynchronously. So, what if I want to perform some action in response to an execution of a request? For example, here I have a foo method, right? And I send the self this foo method. So sometime in the future, this foo will be executed asynchronously. And once that happens, then I want this statement to be executed. This token here is a symbolic representation of foo's return value. Right? So there's a specific token for referencing return values of messages that you've just sent. What effectively happens is this at symbol returns a continuation. A continuation, again, is a place in the code where you can resume later on. So a continuation is some point in the code where you store the program counter, the values of local variables and whatnot, so that later you can reactivate that point in the code by jumping back into that point of the code, restoring all the values of the local variables and continue execution. So this at places a continuation for please continue when this stuff on the left hand side is finished. Right, and then it continues, and this token is then a return value of self.foo somewhere. Right. You can even have multiple return values, right? If I have multiple messages that I place in the mailbox, then I should be able to refer to the aggregated return value of all these messages that I've placed. Right here I've placed self.foo 1 and self.foo 2 into the mailbox of self. So it's executed sometime asynchronously. And then with this token is a reference to all the return values of self and of foo 1 and foo 2. Right? So I can even refer to multiple return values of asynchronous methods. Okay. As I've said, these messages are placed in mailboxes asynchronously. Asynchronous message passing loses your synchronization of messages, right? It's asynchronous, no ordered mailboxes, so there's problems with synchronization. Let's say I have a bit of code here. What I want to do is print hello world and then print salsa. That is what I want. What actually happens is I execute say something places hello world in the mailbox, and then it waits a bit, and then salsa is placed in the mailbox. So far, so good. What, however, happens is all of these agents can be located on different machines. Right? So this say something can be located on machine zero. Right? That works. And then standard output is located on another machine. It's located here. So the standard output agent is here, self is here, and the code that runs here can run on another machine. Right? So I have multiple machines involved, and they're all sending messages without any ordering. So even if I've written the at symbol there, a different order can be placed. Let's see, I've tried to draw here. Right? So executing hello world sends a message. Continues execution asynchronously, so continues for the at statement to print salsa because the message has arrived in the mailbox, and salsa is sent to the mailbox, so the mailbox of console. So it can print, the console has now messages for print salsa and print hello world in its mailbox, and those two are asynchronously random ordered messages, so it'll execute them in different orders. So at is perhaps not always enough if you have multiple machines involved. Okay, so we need some form of barrier. We want to guarantee that once that hello world is printed, code should continue execution from that point on. So we want to have some sort of barrier mechanism. That's how that works with async current continuation. At current continuation says, if once you finish that piece of code, remember where we were, on what machine, and continue the rest of the code from wherever this guy is located. So this current continuation stores the current machine as well as the local variable values and program counter. So this current continuation stores what machine is currently executing. Once it sees this standard output stuff going on, it'll remember that there is a continuation stored and execute this print line salsa at wherever hello world is currently located. So it prints hello world, so line 2, goes to the console, remembers the current continuation and continues execution here instead of continuing execution there. So this at current continuation says, where on what machine should I continue on? I should continue on the machine that holds the current program counter. Right? So it continues here. Print salsa and sends a message to the console again. So now it will correctly print hello world salsa instead of salsa hello world. Okay, a Fibonacci example. Another simple one. So this behavior of Fibonacci is again one of these agents where we send an add message or a compute message to. So this would be add then. No, it's in the same behavior. It works. So you send a compute message to self, send another compute message. So there are now two messages in the mailbox, and we continue execution wherever the last executed message was. So if you have a number of machines, this current continuation, so this add method will be executed at the last machine holding the message. Right? Of course, there's only self, so there's only one message, one machine, so it works. No, it's multiple machines, right? Because I do a new Fibonacci each time. That's a trick. I do a new Fibonacci. This new Fibonacci can be allocated on a different machine. And on the last machine where execution is, there is where I execute the add method. Yeah, that's how it works. Right. So then perform this compute, wait till it's finished with this add method, I wait till the message, the return value has been created, right? And then execute this standard out once I've got a return value of compute. So there's lots of parallelism here. And it's all hidden. All the parallelism is hidden in this implicit message passing. Synchronizing resources. Synchronizing resources is the idea of synchronizing resources is no parallel programming pattern works best for all programming problems. If you have a programming problem where you need to solve it recursively, then you need to have some sort of synchronization method that works for recursive programming best. If you have a matrix processing problem, right, then some parallel for data parallelism works best. Right? If you have multiple machines, then you need to have some sort of fork join style parallelism. If you have multi-core, then you need to have threads and coroutines. So depending on what kind of problem you're trying to solve, you need different mechanisms for solving them. The idea of serializing resources is just put everything in a language and see how it works in the end. Just give it a good mix and see how it works. So we have remote procedure call, threads, processes, explicit receipt of messages, implicit receipt, asynchronous, synchronous message passing, whatever you can think of, we throw it in there and we mix it up. The interesting thing is then where the interactions occur. Does asynchronous message passing work well with coroutines? Right? Do these two mix well? Right? That's the interesting result of SR. MPD is a more modern version of SR, where you have an actual virtual machine. So method invocations. You can just perform a normal sequential method invocation, as you're using Java, C++, Fortran, or fork a new process by sending a procedure invocation to a new process, rendezvous, as we've seen it before in Ada, or send a message to another process. Right? Simple SR program saying a resource inside of a resource execution is from top to bottom, so prints write, prints hello. Here's Fibonacci with SR. Right? Again, execution is from top to bottom, so it starts with get arg, it's a command line argument. Then it's a procedure, it's non-parallel code, so it will just parse. Then a coroutine for executing one statement in parallel to another statement. So this is not a comment, right? This is // is running parallel. So then there's an implicit barrier, and then write the result. That's fairly simple. Right? A little more complex for matrix multiply. Again, from top to bottom, getting the arguments, declare a number of two-dimensional arrays, ABC, create a process, so this is an active statement instead of procedure, which is a static statement, so it's a dynamic active statement that actually executes a number of for each element for 1 to n, from 1 to n, so n squared number of processes are now created. It creates processes doing the inner loop of matrix multiply and assign the value. So this creates a number of processes or threads. And finally, it waits until these processes are finished, and it waits then for all these processes finished, and then prints the end matrix. Right? So you have active and static statements in SR. Transactions. All of the above, what I've just told you, were with SR, were shared memory, racy kind of statements, right? You had to, in SR, specifically look at your variable assignments, and lock and unlock them were needed. So there's lots of work going on, even if you program Java. In Java, you yourself have to write your synchronized blocks and assign them the correct locks. With databases, these locks are transparent. Right? These are, you just say, I want this piece of code to run atomically. You don't say synchronized, you say atomic this please. That's it. So it's write atomic, A++, B++, and the system should somehow guarantee that it's run atomically. Either by creating locks, so converting this code to a synchronized block, or transactionally. Transactional execution means try it, if it fails, try again. Transactional execution means try until it's applied correctly. That is transactions. These transactions you can then nest, right? You can place one transaction into another transaction. What is then the semantics? It depends on what kind of programming language you are looking at. Some transactional systems then commit the inner atomic towards the outer scope, so it commits directly to global memory. Some transactions commit to the inner scope, so to the inner atomic. There are differences here because you can write a parallel 4 in the middle as well, right? So an atomic, parallel 4, atomic in the middle. Right, so atomic, a bit of code, then parallel 4, E is something, right? And then atomic, bit of code, and then do X++. So this X++ in the middle is racy, right? Because multiple threads will be executing this statement in atomic concurrently. Right? So this X++ needs to be safeguarded. So this, whenever this atomic plus plus is executed, it should commit either to the outer atomic or to directly to main memory. Right? This has an effect, of course, if you have another Y++ somewhere in the end. Right? So the Y++ is outside of the atomic, but inside of the inner atomic. If you commit to the outer global scope, right, then these atomics won't occur for a given Y++. If you commit them to the inner scopes, it's a different semantics. Right? So the semantics are different when an inner nested atomic commits to the outer atomic or directly to main memory. It's different semantics, something that you need to take care of. Consensus is to commit to the outer nested atomic. An atomic basically translates to the following pseudocode. This is not really how it works, but this is the pseudocode. Right? So whenever you write an atomic increment, then you record the effects of doing the increment. So the, if it's 3 at the start, and now it should become 4. So effects is A should be 4 in the end. Then you to try and apply it. Trying to apply it means try and acquire the required locks. If you cannot acquire the locks required for A, the internal locks, right? Internally a system has most transactional systems have a lock per amount of memory. Per kilobyte of memory there is a lock internally. So applied OK tries to acquire the lock associated with the address of A. If it cannot, then somebody else is already already trying to commit, then we fail. Otherwise, we've acquired the lock. We should now test if memory still holds 3. Right? If memory still holds 3, then we can apply it. Okay, then we can change main memory. Otherwise, somebody else performed the commit before we could commit our changes. So in memory there's already a 4 and we are trying to write a 4, but we required a 3. Therefore we fail to apply OK and we roll back by releasing the lock associated with the address of A. Right. So this is how it works. The problem is that of transactions is always rolling back stuff that you cannot roll back. For example, here I do an A++. An A++ I can easily roll back. Right? This is throwing away the locks associated with the address of A. But a print line, right, I cannot undo something that's written on the console. I can create backspace characters on the console and take it back, perhaps. But it's not really that nice. Right? So how do I handle print line as a side effect? You can do it the same way as we did with functional languages. Perform lazy I/O. In functional languages, one strategy for handling I/O was performing lazily. Lazy I/O means doing them only once you're sure you cannot undo them. So whenever you see a print line hello, just record somewhere that you needed to do a print line and continue. And only at the commit time, so if you're sure that you've applied OK, when you said finished is true, before you're setting the finish is true, there you do the actual print line. So here is the print line by doing lazy I/O. So any input output should be transactional aware. Right? This transactional stuff is a sort of cross-cutting concern. Everything needs to be aware of these transactions happening if you can write them inside of an atomic block. Some I/O cannot be buffered, right? Some I/O you cannot perform lazily. So there are places where lazy transactional execution fails. What do we do? For example here, right? We read something from a file, and if that's true, then we perform a A++. We cannot delay this read to the end of the file, right? Or end of the atomic block. We cannot delay the read line. Okay, what we can do is create a copy of the file. We copy in the whole file, and then we can read and write on our copy. That works. Only at the end we have a problem, right? If multiple threads are writing to their own private copies of the file, how do we merge these files at the end? That's tricky. Right, then we need some extra mechanism, and now it becomes complex. So another problem with this try rollback things is performance. We are doing parallel programming for performance. If I do something in parallel and it does not gain me performance, then I've just wasted my time. So if I have atomic, then compute something for a long time, then it'll be written as pseudocode, something like this. Record the effects of compute for a long time. If, however, because it's computed for a long time, then the probability of somebody else destroying or changing something inside of what I've read for while computing then I need to roll back. So the longer compute for a long time runs, the higher the probability that my transaction will be interfered with. If I'm interfered, then I need to roll back and need to compute for a long time again. Right? So you need to take care to make transactions as small as possible to minimize the probability of a rollback. Atomos is a language with transactions built in. It's a language with one of these atomic statements built in. These are also translated to one of these try rollback style atomic blocks. Right, there are also a few tricks that they are doing to make programming, general programming, a little easier. So you can write atomic blocks while with wait sets for waiting for conditions to become true, transactionally. So where you were to write synchronized lock in Java, you only have to write atomic, and you don't have to think about what lock should be protecting what data item. So this is a lot easier. That works. So while easier, you need to change the programming model. Right? In Java, if you write your buffer example again, you have a add something to the buffer, and sometimes you need to wait for the buffer to be not full. Right? We need to wait for room in the buffer. And so in Java, you would write a wait statement. The wait statement unlocks the lock, so that somebody else can enter this critical section with a synchronized, add some or remove something from the buffer to make room so you can continue on later on. Right? So the wait unlocks the synchronized so somebody else can enter the synchronized and add something. Right? That's the semantics of wait. Notify wakes up whoever is sleeping on that wait. For transactional semantics for wait, so I had this wait statement, this is original code, and this is Atomos code. So while it's full, we need to again wait, and we need to wait as long as this num entries does not change. As soon as num entries changes, well, we know that the buffer is full. If it's changed, if this variable has changed, it must have become one less, meaning there is now room. Once it happens, we need to retry the transaction. Just throw away whatever we've done and retry the whole thing again. So this is like go to here. Right? It's basically a hidden go to. Go tos are not evil. I already talked a little bit about this nested transactions problem. Right? Here I have a class list with list nodes, and I want to give every list node a unique ID. So I want a list with unique values, right, for its nodes. That means that I must create a function, get unique ID, and then return global handout plus plus. Right? So what I want from get unique ID is to return unique answers every time. Right? That's what I want. Because this is a shared variable, I need to wrap that in an atomic block, right, so to make it correct. But what I've done now is create another atomic block for ensuring that the next pointers in the list and the head pointer are set correctly. Right, so I need another atomic block. And now I have a nested atomic block. Because inside of this atomic block, I call this method, which also has an atomic block. So any change that I have created for global handout will be committed to the outer block for atomic. Right? So this commits the change to global handout to the outer atomic block. And it also reads from the outer atomic block. This may not be what we want. Right? Because the same global transaction will read the same inner nested transaction value. So what we want is another semantic for open. So open means both atomic and once you've done, commit your changes to the global scope, to main memory directly, without committing or reading from inner transactional scope. So this will read for the value of global handout from main memory and commit its changes to main memory as well. and it will not commit to this outer atomic block, right, to avoid committing to an inner atomic block, committing then to an outer atomic block, and then committing to main memory. This staging we can avoid. All right. Another way to get around the race condition problem. Okay, race conditions happen most of the times because people forget to write a synchronized block. Huh? You forget a synchronized block, and that introduces races. If the programming language can ensure that you never forget a synchronized block, then you also write race-free programs. Huh? So we need to avoid race conditions, and we need to avoid a programmer forgetting a synchronized block. So this is atomic mutual exclusion. With atomic mutual exclusion, you annotate the data for atomicity. You do not annotate the code. So in Java, you annotate the code by changing writing synchronized in the code. With automatic mutual exclusion, you annotate the data. You say this data item should always be synchronized. Whenever I access that data item, it should be enclosed in a synchronized block. So whenever you use some data, the compiler will automatically generate the appropriate synchronized. So the compiler adds the synchronized. You don't have to write the synchronized. The only thing you as the programmer have to do is correctly annotate the data, the objects. Right? So have a class share data with an int a, right? And you as a programmer have to write your synchronized blocks. And you will easily forget something for synchronized. Place them at the wrong place, forget them altogether, use the wrong lock. It'll happen, guaranteed. Here's an example. What have I forgotten here? What have I done wrong? So I have a prepend, right? And I've marked this head node as atomic, right? Meaning whenever I access this head, I should insert a synchronized block around it. This is already at automatic mutual exclusion, right? I annotate the data and the compiler will generate this. I don't have to write your synchronized. This synchronized is generated by the compiler. What is wrong? The compiler did the right thing. Right? The compiler correctly sees access head, write a synchronized block. Access head, create a synchronized block. So the compiler did the right thing, but the whole thing is incorrect, right? Because there is the next pointer as well. Accessing the next pointer should also be in the synchronized block. Right? So it becomes a little more complex. Let's say I have a class customer, right? But these two things belong together, and these two things also belong together. Then I annotate them with some sort of symbolic name, as a group name, that says whenever you access date, it should be it should use the purchase lock. Whenever you access item, it should also use the purchase lock. So this purchase says the lock name, effectively. This is an important name for the lock name. What automatic mutual exclusion mostly does is add the lock at the start of the method and at the end of the method where you've used them. It does not try and make the locks as small as possible, the critical sections. It'll make the whole function a critical section. It will not try to make the smallest critical sections as possible. But at least it will be correct. If I have to choose between guaranteed correct or and not optimal, or optimal and not correct, I always choose correct. Right? That's a good plan. So here I access date D and an item. Date and item were both with a purchase lock, so it will change the code to adding a synchronized over the whole method. It will be correct. Right, here's a more exciting example. I have a bank, and the bank has accounts, right? And I need to transfer money from one account to the other account for so many euros. So I need to remove something from one account and add it to another account. The bank will not be satisfied until both transfers happen atomically, right? It should not be that one account is temporarily less, while the money has not yet been transferred to the other account. So both transfers should happen at the same time. Both the deposit and the withdrawal should happen at the same time. That means that there should be one lock over the whole thing. How do we enforce the use of a single lock? So what we do in Atomos is there's an atomic value. So any change to euros should happen while the value lock is taken. That means same for account value, right? Then logging, everything to do with logging should use the same account, same lock, and the unit for locking, the transfer method, is the lock from account, and it's the same for this account. So the transformed code will be synchronized from with the nested lock synchronized to, and then the actual code of the thing. That means that now all the locks are taken automatically, but I have to write the correct annotations. But at least I don't have to think about where to write my synchronized block. It'll be automatically inserted. I just have to write the correct annotations. Right? Here's another example for Atomos. Right? Usually I have to think about using the correct data structures. In Atomos, that job is made a little bit easier by allowing annotations on data structures. So atomic array list. And the system should be responsible for rewriting this to that version, right? So I don't have to think about what type of collection is correct for my given use. The system should figure out what the correct data type is. Should rewrite that to that without having to write that in the first place. Right. For a linked list, it's a little trickier, right? Because there are pointers to be followed, right? If I have to follow a pointer to get at the correct lock to use, that's a little tricky, right? I should not have to traverse a number of references to find the object, acquire its lock, and then do stuff. That's a little tricky, right? So we need some sort of annotation to mark linked data structures. So I don't have to follow all the pointers. So this is the idea here. I have a linked list, and everything that is referenced from this reference of header is protected by the entry lock. So now I have one lock for all the nodes in the list via annotation. I can now no longer forget to add a lock. A lock is automatically inserted whenever I access either header or size. Right? Because this guy, size, list, is the lock name. So here I change size. Do I change size somewhere? Regardless, I've forgotten a bit of code. Whenever I change header or size, that method will have its list lock taken. So this is the lock name. So it'll acquire the list lock whenever I change size or header. And whenever I follow some reference inside of header, it'll be owned by entry. So it'll by the entry class. So all the nested objects will be guarded by the correct lock. Okay. This is all fairly tricky, right? We have to annotate the objects or the data structures. That's a lot of work. Perhaps if we simplify the programming model, it'll be easier to write parallel programs. For example, if you write your program in sort of UML or a state machine, perhaps then programming is so easy that making it parallel will be easier as well. That's the idea of newism file. So you write your program as a state machine, and inside of that state machine, parallelism should be obvious. Right? You perform transitions, and some transitions can be triggered in parallel to other transitions. So there are fairly simple Mealy machines, where, which means whenever you perform a transition, some side effect can occur. Right? Whenever this transition goes from this state to that state, printf happens. A robot arm moves. So things like that. Another way to look at parallelism is using hybrid programming models, where you have both shared memory and local memory. Right? Where, for example, if you have a laptop, there's a main processor and a GPU. And the GPU has its own address space. And the main processor has its own address space. Right? So it, so I need to have some way of partitioning the work across multiple processes. And if you have multiple machines, then over multiple machines as well. This idea of partitioned global address spaces. I have both a local address space and some other address spaces. And I have to somehow manipulate work by explicit sending in between workspaces. So it's it feels like shared memory, but there's a slight change in accessing local memory versus accessing remote memory. So UPC is a parallel extension to C, where there is a partition for, a parallel for statement, where you can trigger a loop iteration across multiple machines. You can also allocate arrays that span multiple machines. So you can create an X terabyte array, where every machine has a partition of this terabyte array, right? So synchronization, barriers, fences, locks for guarding consistency, and so on. There's flat threading, where you first create a large partitioned array of all the address spaces that you have, and then trigger a parallel for loop where every iteration will be placed on the nearest item in your array partition. A single program, multiple data, which means there's a single program where every core in your program works on a different partition of your data. So if I have a main with a hello world, compile it with my UPC compiler, then run it with four address spaces, and I'll run four hello worlds. In this example, I have created a partitioned array. So in shared int A, in shared is over all the machines accessible. So every machine should be able to access this A array. Then that A array should have max number of elements. And number of threads means this is not a multiply. This is not a multiply sign. This you should read as partition. Partition over threads. So if I have 1,000 array elements partitioned over four threads, so everybody gets 200 and something array elements, right? And then here I have if I am thread zero or machine zero, then execute loop. And then a UPC barrier because machines 2, 3, 4 will also run the code. Right. This UPC thread off is interesting. It'll give you the machine that currently owns that partition of the data. So if I have multiple machines, let's say I have three machines, this A array will span all of the machines. Right? This is A. It spans all the machines. Then this thread off will say, thread off this element will be machine one, thread off this element will be that machine. This is a partitioned for statement. So for all elements from 0 to 2, execute this thing in parallel. So all the iterations run in parallel. Or this continue, we'll put that a little bit. Here is a little more complex. Forget this continue. We have a for all, so partitioned parallel for. for all I, for all J, and if I am the owner of this element, so this says the owner of, if I am the owner of this array element, then I should do my computation. Then I am allowed to write to that data item without a race. So if I am the owner of BK, then I should be allowed to access those array elements. So I have to, by correctly specifying thread of, avoid races. I do not write locks and unlocks. By correctly writing this am I the owner expressions, I can avoid all of these lock and unlock statements. Right? That's another way of thinking about synchronization. I can either lock out all the others, or I can only do stuff on stuff that I own. If I am the owner, only then am I allowed to access these data items for modification. Silk. Many programs are naturally recursive. For naturally recursive programs that I also want to evaluate in parallel, it makes sense to have a parallel programming pattern that is most suited for parallelizing recursive things. Right, so Silk, Fibonacci is naturally recursive. Therefore, I extend my language with spawn, and sync. These are virtually the only extensions that I need to add for my language. Spawn says run this potentially on another processor. If that other processor is already full, that is enough to do, then I do it locally. So spawn means potentially doing remotely. And sync means wait for everything spawned to finish. Right. There are races here. For example, I spawn a function, and I spawn that function with an address of my parameter. So this will be an alias to A, right? Because it's an address of. If I then do an increment, then this increment and that increment will run in parallel. So I have a race condition. So Silk does not guarantee you the absence of race conditions. So this is something that you have to, in your programming model, program logic, avoid. Simply said, do not write races and they will not occur. So Fibonacci, this concurrent increment is sometimes useful, right? You sometimes need some sort of, please increment this after all of my spawns are finished. So this is the idea of these inlets, where a summer is an inlet and will be executed once my spawn has finished. So this spawns Fibonacci runs somewhere, and once that has finished, wherever it was, this inlet will be executed on that machine. So this inlet will then increment a little bit for the result and then finish. These inlets will then run sequential. Only the spawns will be run in parallel. Right, so this some sort of implicit synchronization inside of these inlets. So I can trigger some action after a parallel invocation has finished. So it's an ersatz barrier. These some operators are implicit inlets, right? Like if I say plus equal, right? For add something to some existing value, it's an implicit inlet, like a syntactic sugar. There's also an abort. Sometimes you spawn some execution, and after a while you can determine that whatever I've now computed, it's better than whatever somebody else was already computing. So I should kill the other guys. I should be able to kill whatever computation is running in the background where I know that it's superfluous. If something is superfluous, I can just kill it. So I need to have some way in my program logic to detect superfluous computations. And once I've detected something superfluous or old or bad, then I should be able to kill it. And that is the abort statement. So for example, I have some sort of search for best solution, something. I spawn my computational tasks for searching solutions. And if my solution is better, is already worse than the best solution already found by somebody else. So somebody else is running in parallel, found a good solution, and it is worse than whatever I have just computed, then all of my children are superfluous as well. So I do an abort, I know that I am bad, therefore my children are also bad, and therefore I should kill both me and my children. Right? If I am better, right, then I set my new solution and somebody else will be killed. Right? Factor programming. Parallel programming is not just multi-core. Every core in a multi-core has some form of factor instructions. Intel has them, Spark has them, MIPS has them, ARM has them. Everybody has some sort of multimedia instructions in their instruction set for the processor. To get most performance or the best performance out of a processor, you need to somehow do factor instructions. Intel has a MIG processor. They call it Intel Xeon Phi. There's like 64 cores on a single chip. 64, and they're working towards 128. So you have 128 cores on a single chip. However, even if you use all of the cores at the same time, they will not be faster than a quad core. Why? Because you've not done factorization. Only if you do both, if you use all 64 cores and every core uses all the factor instructions that they can, only then will you gain performance over a multi-core. Right? So even if you have many cores, you need to do factor instructions as well. It's not or, as well. Right? To get any kind of performance, you need to do factor instructions. So what are these factor instructions like? Basically, you have a sort of structure with a number of factor elements, and you can, in parallel, add all the elements on a factor in parallel. So add all the elements of one factor to another factor, resulting in another factor, or multiply. Currently, on an Intel processor, there are about 300 different ways of manipulating factors. Like factor merge, factor maximum, factor minimum, factor addition, multiply, factor swap, factor mix. There are even things like factor indirect, where you have a factor A, B, C, D, and you have another factor X, Y, Z, Q. There, this is an index into this array. So if you have 0, 3, 2, 1, split with that factor equals a factor 0, X, 3, 1, 0, 1, 2, 3 is Q, 2 is 0, 1, 2, Z, 1 is Y. Right? There are many, many strange instructions in the Intel instruction set where one factor is an index in another factor, and every one of these has some use in some multimedia video encoder, decoder somewhere. If you have some use case for video decoding, it's a good chance that Intel already has some sort of factor instruction to optimize it. Without using these instructions, your performance will be not good. Okay, then if we know that we need to use these instructions, then it makes sense to add support for them into your language. So for example, CGS is one of these research projects, somewhere here in Germany, I think, even. It's a sort of Pascal-based language where you have factor data types built into the language. It's like a subset of Fortran. In Fortran, everything is an array. Even a single variable, if you have int x, it's an array with only one element. Right? So in Fortran, everything is an array. In CGS, everything is a factor. That's the idea. So this is, you have a factor of floats multiplied by some element of a factor, and then and so on. So everything is factorizable with vector types. And then you see some actual performance. But again, this forces you as a programmer to do low-level stuff. You as the programmer have to factorize your code, try and determine where vectors can be usefully applied. It places a lot of burden on you as a programmer. What other guys are thinking is, let the compiler do it. Let's see how the dice rolls. Right? Hopefully, your compiler has enough intelligence to recognize that this style of loop will match to this style of vector instruction. The current state of the art is an Intel compiler. You have a probability of say 20%. 20% chance that the compiler will recognize that this loop can be factorized. It's not that high, 20%. So even then, if you look in most multimedia encoders, they write their factor instructions in almost hand assembly for best performance. So assembler is not bad. Right? For performance, everybody is still doing this, even though they are doing it for different reasons now, for factor. So CN, CN is another way of getting around multiprocessor, multi-core, many different memories. There is a trend in processor design where you have many cores and every core has some little bit of memory, and it's a trend that processors will have to send messages between groups of cores. So you have a modern processor in say 10 years will probably look like something like this. You have a cluster of cores. Let's say you have a quad core with a channel towards another cluster of processors with maybe three or a number of other cores. And you have another cluster, right? And with perhaps and so forth, right? You have many compute clusters with a number of cores, and between these clusters you will have to explicitly send messages. That is a trend that is going on with network on chip. In these style of machines, you do not want to perform too low-level programming. You only want to say this integer is a local integer, and this integer is something remote, and this integer is something replicated. This is something that you do with CN. So with CN, we assume many small processors, but every processor has some local memory and perhaps something big memory somewhere far away that is very slow, or relatively slow. So if you say poly int x on a many core machine, then you have many x's instantiated with an x on every local memory of a processor. So if you say poly on such a machine here, then there will be an x here, an x there, and an x there. There are three x's. If you have three address spaces. Right. Then there are a number of permutations, right? If I have, if I can name variables with poly, then I have poly int pointer poly sen. This means I have a, this pointer is poly, so every local address space has the pointer to something that is allocated in every processor as well. So poly pointer to poly. Yeah? Or poly int pointer is, there's only one pointer to a poly allocated address. Or int stand poly, poly pointer to an to something local in one machine. This becomes very complex, right? This is not something that we really want to program with. It's a lot of thought that you have to put into this, something like this, to place the polys at the correct place. There are visualizers versus statements where you feed it the program and it'll try and visualize the program to see which poly and which local and mono exists where and when. And you need visualizers to understand your source code. Perhaps the wrong way to go, but it works. There are a number of restrictions, right? You cannot place something poly and mono in the same structure. That doesn't make sense. You have a structure which has a field which exists, where some fields exist everywhere and some fields exist only locally. That's very strange. Right? And if you have a mono structure with poly elements, does that work? Or a poly struct with mono elements? This is something that you have to place some thought in, into language semantics. And that's it for today. I'll see you next week.